right?
Yes.
Hello again, and welcome to another NABBW Author Interview Teleseminar event. My name is Ann Holmes, and I am your moderator and the Boomer-in-Chief of the National Association of Baby Boomer Women, an organization dedicated to educating and empowering women at midlife. This call, like all of those we do every month, is one of the ways we serve our membership. I'll be glad to tell you more about NABBW later, but right now I'd like to introduce tonight's guest, Alfet Agrama, author of the book At the Crossroad. Alfet was born in Cairo, Egypt, and earned her bachelor's degree at the University of Ain Shams in Cairo. She taught English literature and grammar at the University of Cairo. Alfet emigrated to the United States when she was 24 years old and received a master's degree in English literature from the University of California. Well, At the Crossroad is her first novel. Alfet has always been a creative person. She enjoys playing the piano, reading, painting, and sculpting. Alfet has studied painting since childhood, and she has had several single and group exhibitions showcased in many parts of the world, from Paris, Madrid, Nagasaki, Japan, and Los Angeles, among the cities that have been included. Her bright, colorful paintings reflect her love of the Fauvist style of painting favored by Henri Matisse and Georges Braque. Like the Fauves, she paints nature and people with a bright palette that reflects her optimistic view of the world. Professionally, Alfet was CEO of Intersound, a dubbing and post-production studio in Los Angeles, and presently sits on the board of directors at Harmony Gold, a television production and distribution company. She is married and has two children and six grandchildren. Alfet travels extensively, dividing her time between Los Angeles and Paris. She is currently working on her second book. Thank you for joining us tonight, Alfet.
Thank you. Thank you, Anne, so much for having me on your show. I'm delighted to talk to you.
Well, I'm delighted to have a chance to talk to you because having read the book, as well as having read information that is available to me in your biography, I can tell that while this is a fictional book, that it's clearly based on experiences that you had during this exciting, well, I guess it seems exciting, but I don't know. If you think it was exciting or more challenging and frightening to be living during this time in Egypt. But I'm jumping ahead of things and people don't really know necessarily what the book is about. So Alfet, for the benefit of our audience who may not have read the book, let me offer a quick summary and then after that we can get into some questions about the book.
Thank you.
Crucially, the main point of your novel is that the decisions we make at every crossroad in our lives shape our destiny. And the story primarily takes place in Egypt after the Second World War and through into the 60s. At that time, your native country was torn between the East and the West. Having been occupied by the British and then ruled by a corrupt king, political scientists would no doubt say that it was inevitable that by 1952 the country was ripe for a military revolution. And it came. It is against this background that your novel weaves together the lives of four young people born during the occupation. Will each have different experiences, their lives intertwined personally, just as they intersect with the politics of the time. And the four main characters are Nadia, who lives a Western lifestyle but suffers the intellectual and physical repressions imposed upon her by a conservative Muslim father. Melanie, whose mother is British and who enjoys the semblance of a free and emancipated life in a world that never completely accepts her. Sammy, brought up in England, can't escape the fact that he is a product of the Middle East. He successfully escapes from the political restrictions of the military regime, but cannot escape his macho culture. And Hassan, victim of his ideals. His belief in the revolution is shattered when he perceives the corruption of the new government and when the Egyptian army is defeated Suez Canal War. With these four young people as your main characters, Alfet, you weave a story of adventure, romance, joy, and tragedy, all while giving us a glimpse of life in the Middle East in the 50s and 60s. And I have to tell you that I don't know a lot about that time, so I found it very revealing to read this book, and I'd love to have this chance here. I'm excited to have this chance to ask you a few questions and get this discussion started. So without further ado, let me begin by asking you, my first question. As I've said, At the Crossroad is your first fictional book. And I'd love it if you would tell us how the book came about and why you chose to write fiction as opposed to a nonfiction book.
I always like to write, and I've written short things that I never published, and I also wrote movie scripts.
Mm-hmm.
But this book, I wanted to write about growing up in Egypt, because I think it's a time that's disappearing very fast,
mm-hmm.
and it's part of the world that's very different from where my children grew up in the States, and they would never know how, you know, it was sort of a nostalgic, a little bit of memories, and try to record my experiences growing up.
Mm-hmm.
I thought they were special and different from what my kids experienced and my grandkids would experience, and it would be interesting for them and maybe for a wider audience.
Oh, absolutely. The stories, I found it fascinating. It wasn't the first time that I've read about, you know, the strict lifestyle that especially Nadia experienced with the, you know, the very patriarchal society, with the
mm-hmm.
fact that her father was the boss of everything. She had a mother who was present, but really, you know, her mother didn't have a lot of say in
yeah.
It seems like, from the way it's written, what I read there, her mother didn't have a say very much in the upbringing of Nadia. So,
yeah,
so
she
I'm
was very traditional and very
mm-hmm.
submissive. Yeah,
right. So mm-hmm. let's talk a little bit about what it is like for a young girl growing up in Egypt in the 1950s.
Yes.
Oh, just go ahead and tell me a little
bit, and
I've got
1950s. It was already sort of emancipated. We had the British occupation. There was a lot of European influence. But, of course, it's basically an Islamic country, and
mm-hmm.
the traditions survived, especially with women. Women were sort of protected, or they thought that keeping them sheltered is protecting them from the world, and people, young girls, were brought up to marry an arranged marriage, a family arranged a marriage, and they didn't go to college, generally speaking. They were raised to be mothers and got married very young, sometimes
mm-hmm.
15 years old or younger. But it was also a time when women in Egypt had already gained the vote. We could vote. And we had removed the veil. I was never veiled. My mother was never veiled. My grandmother mm-hmm. was never veiled, as far as I know. So there were a lot of contradictions.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of changes. You know, the war changed a lot of things.
Right. Were the contradictions apparent to you, or living through that time, was it just you accepted it because that's the way it was?
Of course it was apparent. We went to
okay.
the movies. We saw
mm-hmm.
American movies, and Doris Day and Esther Williams. And
mm-hmm. Okay.
And but we couldn't do the same thing. We couldn't go dancing, and most of us couldn't wear a bathing suit except during women's hours, which was usually from 6 to 8 in the morning
mm-hmm.
on the beach.
Mm-hmm.
So we lived this contradiction very, and of course we questioned it, and it troubled us. We also read a lot of novels
mm-hmm.
in English and in Arabic that presented a different life from what we were living.
Okay, so there were American influences then in the movies and
in books
that you read.
Magazines. I
mm-hmm.
remember I read Seventeen magazine and Glamour
mm-hmm.
and I don't remember what else, but yes, we grew up reading you know, other than the Arabic magazines, we read the English magazines and went to movies regularly. We had a lot of conflicting traditions thrown at us. Yes,
I would, because when I recall parts of the book where where Nadia is getting up at 5 a.m. so that she can make a phone call to Sammy, if I recall, you know, that she was having to be so surreptitious about that. She certainly didn't want her father to find out that she was on the phone at that time. And that, you know, I'm sure any parent, and even in the United States, to find out that their daughter was getting up at 5 a.m. to talk to a boy, they would have been a bit upset about that. But I'm sure that it was a much more major upset in the Egyptian or any Muslim community.
Yeah, it was taboo. It was taboo. It was something that you didn't do. And it was really difficult because, of course, teenagers are teenagers, and once you're restricted, you tend to rebel. And if you're on your own, usually you do the wrong thing, and you don't have any guidance from your mother or from society. So it's easy to make mistakes. You don't know enough to decide what's right and what's wrong, and you're confused about all these taboos.
Now, in the book, Nadia and Melanie meet at a school that they attend, which sounds like it was a very progressive school.
It was a missionary school in Cairo.
Okay.
And so they were studying in English and reading English books, and the teachers were young English women who were conservative. They were religious. Mm-hmm. It was a missionary school, but still they had come all the way from a faraway country on their own. They were single. They would go out at night alone and do things that the girls never could do.
Mm-hmm.
So we learned about life in America and in England, and we learned British history, American history.
Well, I think that would make sense to learn the history. I'm glad that you had that opportunity, because certainly I think that knowing a little bit, especially of the British history, would help you to make sense of the political and military struggles that were occurring in the Middle East in the 1950s and the 1960s.
Yeah, of course. It was an interesting, for all its problems, it was very interesting, because we were we had an overview of the world much more than, you know, some young people in America.
Mm-hmm. I would think so.
So we were always listening. The radio, for example, we had programs in French, in English, in Greek, in Arabic, of course, and I don't remember what, Italian. So we would listen to all of these languages. I speak 5 languages because I grew up with all these languages.
Mm-hmm.
And it helped. It's an education itself, just living in a place like that where many cultures clash and intertwine and live together in peace.
I think that it would be a fascinating experience as long as you felt that you were safe. And I don't know that that was something that you would think about as a young person.
It was very safe.
Okay, good.
And, you know, more safe than today, because there were no armed people. The basic thing, the crime was petty crime. There were no guns around. You could go out at night safely, women, you know. And you were you had someone with you, but you could walk the street at night. You can without being threatened. It was quite a simple and safe life, I think, until later.
Okay. Excellent. I'd like to talk a little bit more about the book's characters, because I'm pretty sure that they're based on real people that you knew growing up. at that time in Egypt. And I'd love it if you could give us a little bit more insight into the characters. I'm guessing that you can't say, well, Melanie is based on my friend Marie or anything like that. You know, I think that they're probably composites of people, but I'd love to hear what you would have to say about it.
Most of them are composites, and Melanie is made up of three people I knew, and who shared the same mixed heritage of having a foreign mother, a British mother, an Egyptian father. So they were living a very European kind of life. They went to a sporting club. They went on dates. They they took the public transportation. I couldn't, you know, do anything like that. And Nadia, who's a little bit like me, she couldn't take a tram, and she couldn't do a lot of things. Her best friends were doing things that she couldn't do, and it was sort of frustrating and fascinating, like living parallel lives. But it still affected, like Melanie, what became a famous dancer. She had a career and she was independent. She married for love, but she married a traditional man. And the traditional man started imposing on her. He was very religious and very strict and very jealous, and he wanted her to, he couldn't convert her, but he wanted her to be like a traditional Egyptian woman, you know. He made her stop her career, and he ended up locking her up to keep her safe, so to speak, which is the logical ending to all this this crazy controlling business. You don't trust women. And she was very fragile mentally and physically, and he ended up, you know, destroying her. It's just that, you know, love is sometimes, young people fall in love, but then they don't realize how different they are. It's even today, you know, people get married and after 6 months they just are so incompatible.
But, Absolutely. In
the olden days, divorce wasn't so easy. Women were not prepared to work on their own or live on their own. It's harder in the Middle East. So young women were sort of trapped into unpleasant marriages. Nadia is the same thing. She also fell in love with all the intrigue she went through and going in secret to meet a guy who was from the same social stratus and the same education. And yet they had problems, like any marriage or any relationship. So it's not, it's universal, I think, also. So I tried to show that the struggles, especially the women, have a hard time. The men have struggled also, but they have their career and they can go through life in spite of their domestic problems. It doesn't affect their lives. They continue with their careers. They continue with their success or failure, notwithstanding love or falling out of love or marriage or having kids or stuff like that, sort of. And I think this is also happens with women everywhere in the world until very recently. That they sometimes they suffer more because they were less prepared to be independent, and so that was part of what I wanted to show is the importance of women having a life of their own.
Okay, excellent. Now, one thing I was curious about is Sammy is a doctor when we first meet him, or well, he's studying to be a doctor, I believe, when we first meet him, and he becomes a doctor. And in the United States in these days, we tend to relegate doctors and physicians to a elevated social status. But in the time of Downton Abbey, I find that, you know, I'm sure you've had a chance to watch some of that.
Of course, I've watched every single show.
Right. And one of the things that I found so surprising about Downton Abbey was that in that time period in England, the doctors were not considered to be the same social status as the people who are living in the
of course.
Houses.
You're right. Well, in Egypt, a doctor was a little bit looked up upon because he needed to go to so many years of college, 7 years of college, and specialize and all that. But it still isn't like in America.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't make a lot of money. They're usually middle to poor. Middle class,
okay.
And they're usually dedicated people who go into medicine because they want to serve humanity or they have a calling. It's a good life, but if someone once is ambitious, it's not. It's a very restricted. It's a hard career. You don't get rich. And Sammy had other plans. He wanted more adventure, and
certainly he did. I don't know how much we should say, because I don't want to necessarily give away the end of the story. But he certainly did have other plans.
Yeah, you're right. A doctor wasn't as put up on a pedestal as in the States, I think. The States, more than any other country, doctors have been sort of put up on a pedestal, and they earn too much money.
Well, I think I can understand where you're coming from with that. I certainly do. Let's talk a little bit about Hassan. We haven't said his name yet. We haven't really talked about him, so... So you have given me the idea that he's a victim of his ideals, that he believed in the revolution,
he was an officer, and he was an idealist, and he really believed in the revolution, dedicated himself to the principles of the revolution. When it started as a socialist, nationalistic movement, and the whole nation got very excited because it was the first time that Egypt had an Egyptian president since the time of the pharaohs.
Mm-hmm.
We've been ruled by everybody, the Romans, the Greeks.
I never thought of it that way, but you're right.
The Persians, the Turks. So,
how did Cleopatra let that happen?
Because she was Greek. She started. Her family was Greek.
Well, yes,
she was really very... She learned how to speak the language and made herself into an Egyptian. I mean, she was a very brilliant woman. And politically, she embraced the culture and the gods, and considered herself Egyptian. But most of the pharaohs and the kings and whoever they came from, Turkey or from England, they considered themselves, they didn't even speak Arabic. The king, the final king Farouk, who we kicked out when the revolution came, didn't speak. He spoke broken Arabic. He spoke French all the time. And he was a Francophile. He was educated in England, and all his family didn't consider themselves Egyptians. Their origin was in Turkey and Albania. And so, you know, when Nasser came, an officer from a very poor Egyptian family, and people were very excited by the idea. It ignited a lot of nationalism, and it worked for a while, but, you know, there are certain pressures and certain things happened, and in the end, we've had a series of disappointments, to put it mildly. Mm-hmm. So this guy, Hassan, was part of the revolution. Most probably he fought with these, he fought against the occupation, he fought against Israel, he felt that he had a mission to make Egypt an Egyptian country instead of somebody else's puppet or, you know, it was used, Egypt was used like a plantation. The British forced them to plant cotton, which they took to England to make cloth, like they did in India, you know, Gandhi's story. We had the same thing.
Right.
And we were, we had a lot of British schools and a lot of people spoke English. The signs in the streets were in English, the names of the street. You know, it was an occupied, it was part of the British Empire.
Mm-hmm.
So, Hassan had this glorious ideal, but his failure came in his relationship to women, because he was a devout Muslim, and Muslims feel that women are inferior, and men have to dominate them. They treat them like children, and that they can't be trusted. So he married a very wild she was a dancer, after all. She was British.
Right.
She looked British, and she had a wild youth.
Mm-hmm.
And he couldn't handle it, so he tried to force upon her his ideas physically.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't want to tell the whole story.
No, of course not. but let's talk a little bit about from the point of view of since these main characters and the other characters in the book are basically, to my understanding, they're based on what we might call archetypes of people that you knew when you were growing up.
Yeah.
Would you feel that it's easy or more challenging for you to relate to the characters?
For me, I knew those characters.
Mm-hmm.
It was easy to relate to them because I lived among them, and I could identify many people who had various aspects of these characters. So it was my youth exemplified in, you know, few people.
Right.
And this is mainly, it's always easier to talk about people you know. rather than invent them.
I would think so, because when you can talk about people, even if it's from an archetypal kind of a category, you at least you know, because you didn't invent them, you know that that's how they actually would function, how they would actually think.
Yes. The thing is, of course, some of them I made worse than they ever could be, because I took, you know, they were not just one person.
Mm-hmm.
And some incidents were taken from various people. And, any writer, you know, most writers look around and observe and write about people they know.
Mm-hmm.
But they end up being fictional because they're not exactly what real people are. They're always a little bit changed by the storytelling.
Mm-hmm. And that's what makes it fiction and not nonfiction. If it was exactly the people, then I guess you'd be writing history or
of course
nonfiction.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I found them very relatable people, so I think that that tells me that they are, you know, real people. They weren't like stick figures. To me, they were multidimensional people with challenges and frustrations and I found it a great place to live within that book and to deal. Not that it was a comfortable place to be. There was some challenging things that they had to deal with, but I found it very a believable book. So I applaud you for writing a book fictional book that I found so believable. Next, I'd like to ask you. I'm not sure exactly what year you left the Middle East, but you did come to the United States, and so you don't necessarily have. You might tell me you can't answer this, but I'm just curious whether you think it's easier or harder to be a woman in the Middle East today than it was in the 1950s and 60s.
Oh, it's a good question. It's I think it's harder in many ways. The only thing that's different is that most women, most girls, go to school.
Mm-hmm.
And many of them are going to the university. When I went to the Cairo University, we were a minority.
Mm-hmm.
And I was already married, so I was the only married woman. I mean, people were staring at me all the time. And I was pregnant half the time I went to college. So that was shocking to many of the men and the girls. To put it in a nutshell, my father held a meeting and told my husband, I didn't give you my daughter to prostitute her when he found out that I was going to go to college. He thought that college was the same as prostitution.
Oh, my. That I wouldn't have seen that.
So that
I wouldn't have anticipated that.
That is, well, maybe it was only my father. Maybe
mm-hmm.
The general feeling was if you let a girl go to college and mix with the boys, then she's going to end up badly. And
mm-hmm.
it was, so that was hard. It was hard for girls to, but there were many women who got PhDs and were professors. And even when I was a little girl, I have relatives who were in high positions in the government, women. And some of them went to Paris and got PhDs, but they were the rarity. It wasn't common. Now there are a lot of women who are doing very well as doctors, lawyers, engineers. So this is one thing. It's easier
mm-hmm.
to get an education. It's easier to get a job. Women are doing better than men. There is a backlash. There is a religious backlash that sprung. Don't ask me how or why, because Egypt was always secular. And religion, we had every religion. We had a big community of Jews. We have a lot of Christians. We have Copts, Protestants,
mm-hmm.
Catholics, and Muslims. And we never clashed. I mean, we lived in the we didn't have ghettos. We all lived in the same street. We went to the same school, and worked together. But this religious backlash is very. I don't know what caused it exactly. I guess it's anger with the West.
Mm-hmm.
A repressive government that didn't let opposition, political opposition, flourish. So all the opposition went into the mosque because it's the
mm-hmm.
only place they could gather and discuss. There are many, and now we have this very big problem of the traditional Muslims who want to go back to the Middle Ages. I'm very much against it, and if I might talk a little bit too. But in that sense, it's much harder now for women, because the first
mm-hmm.
thing is let's veil the women, let's keep them in the house. They want to reduce the age of marriage from 16 to 13. as if we need more kids. We are already
right.
have too many children. No birth control. It sounds familiar, you know. You have a few of them here in America.
I was just going to say, I don't think Egypt's the only country that's dealing with this right now.
I know. There is this movement towards radical Islam or radical religions, conservatism, that is crazy, in my opinion. And that hurts women in every sense of the word.
I remember being in college in the 1970s, and the Equal Rights Amendment was passed, and I remember being so proud of it, you know, that
yeah.
that this had happened, and that women were, you know, having full equal rights guaranteed by law. And now I look at some of these politicians, and I'm just thinking, how did this happen in my lifetime? How did we backtrack this much? Because, you know, I thought we took care of that in 1970.
I know, even in America, where, you know, you have a
right.
secular government. In Egypt, the Islamic law governs inheritance and marriage. And a woman mm-hmm. in Islamic law is half a man. When my father died, I inherited half of what my brothers inherited. Like if my brother inherits $100, I get only 50.
Mm-hmm.
And on and on. And I think there are things like testifying in court. A woman's testimony is not as valid as a man. There are basic things in the constitution of Egypt that are influenced by the Islamic Sharia, even at that time and now also. They can't get rid mm-hmm. of it. So that, of course, is going to affect a woman's future and her independence, even though many women are the breadwinners now. They
mm-hmm.
make more money than their husbands, but they are still considered half a person.
Right.
So it's a weird, conflicting situation that everybody suffers because of it. And what can I tell you? I mean, there are similarities to all conservative religions,
mm-hmm.
More than you can imagine, but, you know, everything has its specific peculiarities. And so this is why now I think women are better off in many ways. Many of them don't get married at 16 or 15.
Mm-hmm.
They finish college first. They meet someone. They usually, the parents don't impose, unless they're peasants, you know, working the
mm-hmm.
fields and they're not educated. They
right.
have the right to choose their husband, and it's much more open in that way.
Mm-hmm.
But there are still problems. There are still problems because of this Islamic movement. So
are you saying that the role of religion is bigger today than it was in the 60s and 50s?
Yes.
Or not?
Yes.
Okay.
We had a president who wanted to change the constitution into a religious constitution. They toppled him. And they
mm-hmm.
put, now we've got a military officer who is trying to make a constitution based on, civil law, not religious law. But I think always includes some issues taken from the religious books, like the marriage laws and paternity and things like that that affect a woman's life, you know. The right to divorce. A man can
mm-hmm.
divorce much easily his wife than a woman can divorce her husband. He can take away her kids. There are so many things that are very unfair to women that exist up till today.
Right. Do you see, from the point of view of that you've lived outside of Egypt for a number mm-hmm. of decades now, do you see that this is going to continue on this way, or do you think that there would be a uprising, maybe of women or maybe of men and women, that would say this just isn't right?
Well, there
right.
was. They did. When Morsi tried to make to put back Sharia law. There was an uprising, and they kicked him out. So there, people didn't accept it. And now, but I don't know. It's so confusing for me. But they put a lot of those religious people in jail.
Mm-hmm.
And who knows? You know, without any court, they just put thousands in jail. And now we have a military government. I don't know if it's any better. It's certainly secular, but it's more the human rights and civil rights are still questionable. But it's no longer based on the Islamic law, because we've got a lot of Christians living in Egypt and a lot of other religions. It's just crazy to try to impose
the Sharia law.
Sharia law like Saudi Arabia in, on a place like Egypt. It didn't work, but who knows? Who knows? You never know this crazy world we're living in.
Well, I can't remember the name of the book, but I remember one of the first books that I reviewed after I bought the NABBW was about an American woman who married into a man who was from the Middle East, not from Egypt.
I think I know the story. Yes, and then he took her kids. He took her children away or something.
I think that did happen, but early on, when they were in the happy times of their marriage, she was having to learn how to live with, you know, wearing the veil and like she had formerly, you know, been able to drive a car, and now she could only drive a car at night when nobody might be around to see that it was a woman driving a car. And
I know.
And I was thinking, I'm not quite sure how an American woman could do something like that. And yet, I happen to actually know. I spent a number of years living in the Quad Cities, which is in Iowa and Illinois on the Mississippi River, and there's a pizza company that was started in Davenport, Iowa, called Happy Joe's. And for a number of years, they actually had a Happy Joe's franchise in Cairo. I don't know if it still exists, but in the 70s and 80s, in 1970s and 80s, I believe that this Happy Joe pizza franchise existed in Cairo. And one of Joe Witte's daughters went to Egypt to be working at that restaurant, and she ended up that she had to have a safe word before her family would let her leave to live in Egypt. But she ended up having to be rescued because the life was just conspired against her being an American. She didn't understand this lifestyle. So I do understand a little bit about the fact
difficult.
That.
I can't go back to Egypt.
Yes.
I have a hard time going back to Egypt. I have family there, and I have a problem because I offend them. The way I dress, the way I talk, you know, and I feel as if I'm a stranger. They're very subtle things. And if you're American and you marry an Arab and you want to live in his family, even if he's sort of enlightened or if he's Europeanized, you'll have a hard time because your neighbors, your mother-in-law, et cetera, it's going to be difficult.
Right.
It's true that there are a lot of very modern thinking people in Egypt, but we're talking about the majority. There are a lot of different kinds of families, different cultures in Egypt, and religion was always taken as a private matter and very light. It wasn't, people didn't pray five times a day or go to the mosque five times. It was, you know, you had your religion, you keep it to yourself because your neighbor is Christian and you always... You went to church with the Christians for their marriages and, you know, it wasn't like a segregated society. So things have changed. Things have become more Arabized, Islamified, if I'm inventing new words, I don't know.
I think it might be inventing, but I think we can understand what you mean. All right, well, I'm not sure that you and I can do anything about that, so let me depart a little bit from that discussion and go in a different direction here. I'm fascinated about your history, about how you left that world and came to the United States, and the things that you did when you came here. To me, it's just an amazing trajectory, a wonderful path that you followed, although, like you said, probably not that your family thinks it's wonderful. But you started out by earning your bachelor's degree at the University of, I think it's pronounced Ain Shams, in Cairo, and then you got a master's degree in English literature from the University of California after you emigrated. How did these studies how did they impact what you've done, and would you say that they had anything to do with your becoming a writer, or is just becoming a writer something?
You know, I've always been an English major. I've always written. I was editor for my school magazine, my high school magazine, and I always wrote and wanted to write. But when I came here to UCLA, I was immersed in English literature. I read a lot, and it was interesting. I remember my first professor was from the South, and I was going to attend some lectures on American literature, and I couldn't understand a word he said. I came home crying. I told my husband, we don't speak English. They're speaking a different language.
I lived for a while in Georgia. That's why I'm laughing, because I know what you're talking about.
Oh, God. I got used to him. You know, I did the seminar with him, and he was lovely. But the first few times, I just couldn't follow. I couldn't follow the accent. It was so difficult.
You had to do translation twice.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
To try to understand what he was saying.
But, it was interesting. And why I moved so much was really because I followed my husband, and my husband was an adventurer.
Okay.
So we moved. He wanted to be in the movies, and he was doing movies, and so we moved wherever there was work. At that time, there was a crisis in the United States, and there were no jobs in the movie industry. Mm-hmm. So we went to Beirut and worked there, and he created the movie industry there, and then we went to Italy and worked in the movie industry there. And I, of course, had to interrupt my PhD, and I started helping him out and with the writing scripts and with anything to do with the movie business. So I got dragged into it, and so this is what happened, but it was an interesting life. It isn't what I thought.
Can imagine.
I thought I was going to be a professor of English, but I ended up being, I don't know what, I ended up being a lot of things, which is more exciting.
Oh, I would think, I'm a person who seems to have changed careers many times over the course of my 60-some years, so I understand I'm only guessing that the evolutions that led me from one thing to another is probably the similar sort of thing that happened with you. And to me, that makes life interesting. I think that if I, let me pick on my sister. She will hopefully not hear this and get mad at me, but my sister is only a couple years younger than I am, and she has been a museum curator her entire life. Since she graduated from college, she's done one job, and I cannot imagine that I could do that. I think I would be driven crazy by Now she's risen through the ranks, and now she's the, you know, the assistant curator of a reasonably sized museum. So it's not like she's done the same thing the same.
Yeah.
But I just think I think that the fact that you've traveled, you know, besides Italy that you mentioned and Lebanon, there's London, there is Spain.
Oh, we traveled. We worked in Turkey, and we worked in Persia, and we worked in during the time of the Shah. And so we moved. So it was an education, and it was exciting. I didn't think so at the time. I was so depressed. I wanted to be in one place, and I wanted to get my PhD, and I never did. But now that I look back, I'm glad it didn't, you know, it's different. I started to paint. I started to do other things, and it was interesting.
Well, I took a look online at some of your paintings, and I was just wowed by the work that I found online, and I'm sure that's only a small part of the art work that you've created, but I did when I put together the article about you on the NABBW site, the profile, I included some of the photos some of your pictures online.
Yeah,
I
know.
Thought,
thank you. That was very well done.
Well, thank you.
I'd
love to hear how you became a painter, starting that you wanted to be a professor of English or a professor of literature.
Of course, it all started as a very young girl. I think I was 12, and my parents, upper middle class, let's say. I had a piano teacher coming to the house, and I had an Italian painter come to the house and give me art classes. So he gave me and my mother art classes once a week. I think it was once a week. So I started painting at a very early age, and I made a lot of paintings and exhibited in Cairo. And, of course, there were years when I stopped, when I didn't have time. But when I came, when I was in Italy, my neighbor was an artist. And so I used to go downstairs. Her husband worked nights. He was an editor in a newspaper, and he worked all night. I would go down and work with her. We do sculpting and drawing, and she was a fantastic artist and taught me a lot. And then at UCLA, I took courses. Even though I was studying English, in the summer I took art classes. So I guess it was part of my life all the time, and I always painted. And I enjoyed it. It was relaxing, and it was something I loved to do. And that's how I became a painter.
Well, I think it's wonderful that you did, and that you were doing something that you love to do, because I think we all flourish when we have the opportunity to do something that we love. But now, of course, it wouldn't be fair for our audience to let them hear that you've been a sculptor and a painter and the academic side of your life if we don't also say that you were, and I'm sure this was due to an evolution of the work that you did with your husband, but you were also the CEO of a company called Intersound, which was a dubbing and post-production studio in Los Angeles.
Yes.
And I'm curious, when did you develop the knowledge, the moxie, the things that you need to know to be a business executive, that was a whole other group of skills.
I tell you how I developed it. I was told to do it.
Oh, okay.
By the boss. He didn't have time to do it. He said, you go and you edit this film and you find actors and translate it into Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
So I did. And I learned as I went along. And then slowly we opened the studio with some financing from a partner, and we started dubbing into English, a lot of Japanese cartoons into English,
I noticed that. That was fascinating to me.
It was fascinating, and a lot of and into Arabic. I did a lot of Arabic shows for the Middle East, and into Italian and some French. And what else? A lot of languages. German, we did from German into English. So it was interesting, and it was a fascinating business. It was the beginning of the computer, and the machinery was developing so fast. So it was a whole new world for me. I started working on film, and then it became you could just work on magnetic tape. You know, the computer did all the work, and you could do a more precise dubbing.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it also was interesting because I could write. I wrote scripts in Arabic, and I tried to make them fit to the movement of the mouth. Mm-hmm. And we even wrote songs and sang, and we did everything, acted. So it was an artistic world. You know, the movie business is artistic. It has a bit of everything.
It does.
It has, singing, acting, drawing, and the hardest part is managing the people, managing the actors. It's fascinating because you have a wide scope of things to do, literary, artistic, musical, and then you also have the business side. So, it really is an interesting world. And it's another facet of my life.
Absolutely, and I would think a significant one because I saw a few of the lists of the movies that were part of the list online, and I won't deviate away from our discussion here today to talk about that. But it looked like it was a fascinating job that you did there. But let's get back to the book. I think that it's a wonderful premiere novel, first novel. I'm curious, will you be writing any more novels?
Well, I am writing another one. I'm writing another one that has nothing to do with Egypt. I'm writing about Europe now. I'm writing about Spain, south of Spain. I used to go there a lot. I have many friends, and I met a lot of crazy people. And I think it's an interesting area because there are so many different cultures that are clashing, and they also have a terrible government, corrupt government. Mm-hmm. And so I'm writing about a lot of interesting people that I met, or hopefully I will invent or improve upon reality.
Okay.
And maybe, I don't know, that's what I'm doing. A lot of people want me to write about Egypt, but maybe I'll do both, because I have a lot of stories about the Middle East that I could delve into. So I'm writing a little, but to be honest with you, right now I'm painting a lot because I have 3 shows this year, and I have to produce a lot of paintings. I don't have enough.
I can imagine. Where are the shows?
One of them is the Arab American Museum in Michigan is sponsoring a show here in LA in something called the House of Lebanon.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to be showing there with 2 other artists. And then I have in Ojai, in the Art Center, I'm having a show in May. And I do these boxes that are like little people.
I think I saw them online.
Yeah, so they wanted the boxes, and they didn't want paintings, so I have to make more boxes, more characters. It's a lot of work, but I love it, and it's a labor of love. And then I have another show the end of the month of artwork in also in Ojai. It's sort of an art center here in LA.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So I have many paintings, but I like to have a theme, so I have to also create new things so I don't bore everybody.
Or maybe yourself, you know,
yes,
you need to be creating
true.
Something new all the time to not bore yourself.
Exactly.
Well, I do want to make sure that all of our listeners have heard where those shows are in case they would be interested in and live close enough that they could go visit them. I also want to remind them that your book, At the Crossroad, is available online at Amazon, at Barnes & Noble, and it's also at, I didn't write down the, Ex Libris. Is there
yes.
any place else online
yes.
that besides those three that it's available?
It's going to be available in L.A. in a lot of bookstores.
And okay.
It's going to be available in a lot of the book fairs all over the United States. But
excellent.
mostly on the Internet, they can find it, Ex Libris or Amazon, if they want it quickly.
Sure. Is there anything else that I haven't asked you about, Alfette, that you'd like to tell us about?
Oh, you're. I don't know this. Well, I think you've sort of covered everything.
Well, you know, I didn't know enough about the shows, and you got a chance to tell us about the three shows. That's a lot of shows in a short period of time. So I'm glad we got to find out about that.
And I'm doing some readings in some bookstores in LA.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I'm gonna have to either put it on the internet so people will know, and
mm-hmm.
Or on Facebook or you know.
Right. Well, I know that you have a Facebook page, and I believe it's at facebook.com/Alfette Ograma.
Yeah.
And then you have a website, which is probably one of the places that you would put this information. So I need to remind people of
yeah,
you have a website.
Ollie Ograma Art, I think, and it's usually just paintings, but I think I'm going to start putting information about my book in it.
Good.
Yeah.
That sounds wonderful. Could you spell that so people can find it on the website? Is it
O-L-I? Ollie, O-L-I,
okay.
Ograma, A-G-R-A-M-A, Art, A-R-T.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
and,
excellent.
Yeah. It starts
with .com.
Yes, it starts with www, and it'll
right.
come up immediately, and then you can get all the information of what I'm doing.
Excellent. Well, we are at the top of the hour already, and I haven't had a chance to find out if any of our guests have any questions for you, but let me take a minute here before I let you go tell our listening audience that the lines are open. If anyone has a question for Alfette, all you have to do is just speak out, and we will hear you and let you ask your question. Anyone here who would like to say anything, ask anything? All right. Well, I see that we have guests on my screen, but they don't seem to want to talk, so I guess we've maybe answered all of their questions, Alfette, and that's wonderful. So
right.
I want to thank you for joining me this evening and our audience for joining us as well for this wonderful and informative call. And I want to remind people again that you can look at the OllieOgramaArt.com website or find Alfette on Facebook if you would like to know more about what she's doing in the near future. If you'd like to know anything more about the National Association of Baby Boomer Women, you can find us in a number of places online, too. Our website is www.nabbw.com, or we have a Facebook page at facebook.com/nabbw, and we have a forum at boomerwomenspeak.com. Those are all places where you can find information about the National Association of Baby Boomer Women. And with that, Alfette, I don't know that there's anything else that I have to add for this evening, so I'm going to close the call here, unless I'll give one more chance for anyone to ask a question.
Well, thank you so much.
Well,
absolutely. It was a pleasure talking to you.
I enjoyed it, too. I learned a lot, and I thank you for your time. And thank you very much for getting together with us so we could do this. And I'll say good night.
Thank you. And I hope I'll finish my second book quickly. So
we can that would be great. We'd love to talk about that, too.
All right,
thank you.
My dear. Thank you so much.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye.